Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. On Saturday, 400 activists rallied outside the coal-fired Granttown power plant in West Virginia. They called on Democratic Senator Joe Manchin to abandon his support for fossil fuels and support renewable energy legislation. Several people were arrested. Communities in West Virginia have been devastated by decades of coal extraction, leading to a health and environmental crisis. West Virginia has also turned into ground zero for the opioid crisis. According to the Washington Post, over the past decade, nearly 21 million prescription painkillers have been shipped to Williamson, a tiny town in West Virginia. Devil Put the Coal in the Ground is a powerful new documentary that explores how all of this happened. It's a cautionary tale of unfettered corporate power and an elegy to a vanishing Appalachia. In the film, we meet a wide array of people who have all lost loved ones to the coal industry. In this clip, we will hear from Bo Webb, a Vietnam vet and anti-mountaintop removal activist, and James Nelson, a gun and pawn shop owner.
We would go to the town of Whitesville. That was our town. And we had two theaters, bowling alley, two drugstores. It was just thriving. And it was all underground coal mining. And this was when, after the unions came into play. And so people were making money. They were spending money. It was great. The economy was great. The 1970s, it started changing. Massey Energy came on Coal River, and they bought, the first thing they did was buy out large coal company called Elk Run. He closed it, Don Blankenship. And then he reopened it and hired all non-union workers. Then he bought the next coal company up the valley. Did the same thing, close it, reopen it. And he had this master plan, and he took the union down. Whitesville became a ghost town.
Through the 70s and 80s, it was when they were having all the strikes for benefits and stuff like that. My dad was out of work for 180 days straight before they ever went to work, back to work, for benefits. And they got it. It's part of the history. I mean, it goes back, you know, to the turn of the last century that, you know, they had to literally kill people to get decent working conditions in this state. And within a generation, it's all gone. All of it. There'll never be a UMWA mines in this state again. If it is, it'll just be a token.
That is James Nelson, a gun and pawn shop owner, and Bo Webb, a Vietnam vet and anti-mountaintop removal activist. Bo Webb will be joining us in about 10 or so minutes. That is a clip from the powerful new documentary, Devil Put the Coal. The Devil Put the Coal in the Ground. And it is going to be screening at this year's Green Film Festival in San Francisco, which takes place April 14th to April 24th. Devil Put the Coal in the Ground will be shown on April 17th at 6 p.m. at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. The film will also be shown online. Joining us today are two co-directors, Peter Hutchison and Lucas Sabian. Peter Hutchison recently produced and directed Requiem for the American Dream, Noam Chomsky and the Principles of Concentration of Wealth and Power, and Lucas Sabian worked on Healing from Hate, Battle for the Soul of a Nation, and The Man Card, White Male Identity Politics from Nixon to Trump. Hi, Peter and Lucas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, how are you? Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, well, thank you for having us.
Well, thank you so much. This is such a powerful film. And the one thing I kept thinking about while watching it is it's one thing to hear about coal country and coal miners like we did during the last election, but to see people and to see the land is such a different experience. Peter, first off, why did you decide to make this film and focus on West Virginia?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. This film kind of flowed very naturally out of another film that we were in the middle of making, Healing from Hate. And we were actually looking for an area in the United States where we were sort of in search of the angry white man, so to speak, to better understand the the phenomenon behind the rise of Trump. And went down to West Virginia initially, and I think in hopes of seeing if we could have conversations with people around this, perhaps somewhat naively. I spent a year of my youth in West Virginia, but that was quite a long time ago. And instead of finding angry white men, we found something very, very different. The interview footage that I came back from West Virginia with was incredibly powerful. It was incredibly sad thing, yet also really captured this incredible spirit of hopefulness around these people who are attached to their land and their traditions in this very soulful way. And we decided, you know, we need to create the opportunity for these people to tell their story. We need to create an oral history of West Virginia, so to speak, and let these people tell the stories of their multi-generational relationship to the coal industry and to exploitation of the people and the resources of West Virginia.
And Lucas, the other thing that was striking is you hear about coal country, but to meet people like Greg Carpenter, a former addict, or Lois Vance, a nurse, Bob Kincaid, an activist, Lisa Henderson, a mom, you've got a judge, a lawyer, politician. It's just such a different, you get such a different sense of what really has happened in West Virginia. Can you talk about what it was like to actually meet people on the ground and spend so much time with them to hear their stories?
Sure. Well, kind of to dovetail on what Peter was just saying, when he came back with the footage, and I was I was the editor on the film as well, and I was going through the footage, and what struck me from the interviews was, you know, the tension between the humanity that these people had in the interviews and the suffering that they had endured. You know, this was not a kind of a top-down film where we went in with an idea of, this is the story we want to tell, and we're going to, you know, pick out people to tell that story. It was quite the opposite. You know, it actually came out of a completely different topic. And it just happened that each person we interviewed had these similarities. You know, each person had somebody in their family, in their direct family, who had, you know, died very young from black lung, from being a coal miner, and also someone who had been an addict or, you know, was an addict themselves. And, you know, that spoke to me personally as a director. I myself am in recovery, and the first interview I went through was Greg Carpenter's footage, and he, you know, just his raw interview in and of itself was so moving to me that I knew instantly that, you know, his story was going to be the backbone of this, and that's how I kind of went about building it out.
It was also just the fact that you told the whole story, because you just get snippets about what's happening there, about the opioid crisis, about coal miners losing their jobs. And Peter, that was also powerful. Just the clip that we heard there, to learn that at one time, these were good paying jobs. There was a thriving community with theaters, independent restaurants. You know, people were able to feed their families, and there was a healthy community there. And then you had some companies, like, for example, one company, Massey, come in to buy union coal mines, fire everyone, and then reopen with non-union workers. I mean, it's such an important story to tell for context about so many of the issues we're facing today.
Yeah, I think that was part of our intent. You know, no history is black and white. No history is simple. No history is devoid of its many contexts. And, you know, I've seen some great films on the opioid crisis or mountaintop removal or the coal industry, but what a lot of them seem to be missing is this interconnectivity. I mean, all of these things are connected to one another. You know, the opioid crisis is it's inherently connected to this soulful connection that West Virginians have always had with the land and the loss of that, the not being able to eat the fish that you've fished out of a nearby lake or stream, not be able to eat the animals that you might have trapped or shot on your land, not be able to eat the apple that grows off the tree in your land, not be able to drink your own water. I mean, those are just punishingly difficult losses that I think when you see how it all fits together and take a step back, I think it provides a very different kind of understanding for all of these different, you know, otherwise siloed issues. And, you know, there's a film that I always have looked at as this sort of loose reference point for what we attempted with the film. There's a film called Darwin's Nightmare, which takes a look at globalization and how all these different factors that came together in Western Africa. And when I first saw that film, it completely floored me. And as we shot in West Virginia and researched, we realized there was something very similar happening here.
Hmm. And what would you add on that, Lucas, just in terms of the story and connecting all of the dots?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, really, you know, I had alluded earlier to these commonalities that folks had, you know, and so we slowly kind of started building a story. And again, you know, this was something that it was a learning process for us, you know. And certainly when you deprive people of the thing that they had been very prideful of, you know, that there's a whole history of people, you know, owning their properties and having this kind of prideful self-sustaining agriculture. And then when that's taken away, and then, you know, you add into that your property value is being decreased, you know, the explosions from the mountain above your property are cracking the foundations of your house. And that there's, you know, constant, you know, toxic dust in the air, that takes its toll on you, you know, and one of the causations of that, you know, is that people got hooked, you know, on opioid pills that were, you know, partially farmed out as a corporate strategy from Purdue Pharma to where they were directly targeting West Virginia. You had alluded to, you know, 21 million pills being, delivered to one small town in West Virginia. And then you know, with the rise of fentanyl now, there's a huge crisis in overdoses there, and it's you know, we really try to capture the suffering of the people through, as Peter said, an oral history.
Well, you both really did an amazing job. That is Lucas Sabian, co-director and editor of Devil Put the Coal in the Ground. Peter Hutchison is co-director of the film, and it'll be screened at this year's Green Film Festival of San Francisco, April 17th at 6 p.m. at the Roxy Theater. It'll also be online, so no matter where you are, you can, and I really hope you are able to watch this incredible film. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Now we would like to welcome Bo Webb to the show. Bo Webb is featured in the film. He was actually in the clip we played in the intro. Bo Webb is a Vietnam veteran and an anti-mountaintop removal activist. Hi, Bo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, Bo, I'm so glad that we were able to get you on the show, because just learning about your story, and then I'm so sorry about the loss of your wife, and just learning about what happened to her. Lucas was just talking about mountaintop removal and what happened when people had to endure the dust, inhaling dust, having dust on their clothes. And you talk about your wife having a flower garden, and every morning when she would wipe off the desk, the paper towel would be brown or black. Would you mind telling us that story again?
Sure. what would happen, they started blasting on the mountain directly above our home. And we were getting a lot of dust. And then that changed, and it became, sometimes it would be dry dust, sometimes it would be slimy, blackish to dark green to blackish, brownish. And every morning, my wife would go out, you know, she'd be out in the yard early, flower gardens, and we had vegetable gardens and all that. And she would wipe down everything on our deck, you know, the patio furniture, everything. And these towels would have the stuff all over them. And I actually showed that to the United States Geological Survey. They came, I had talked with them, and they came in and they put up dust filters at my house. And in 2 weeks' time, those filters were black. And so we were breathing the stuff, but I was gone a lot. I was in Washington, D.C. trying to pass the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, which would stop mountaintop removal. So I was in D.C. quite a bit during that time. And but I was well aware of, when I was home on weekends and whatnot, I'd see the same thing that my wife was seeing and what she was cleaning up. And she just suddenly, it was very sudden. She wasn't feeling well. She coughed up a little bit of blood, and that was on December the 3rd. And March 3rd, 3 months exactly, she was gone. And not just her. My neighbor right down, four doors down from us, Ann Ruth was her name. She suddenly got ill. She went in the hospital, and she was dead in a couple of weeks, and it was cancer. And that's the big thing down there, is lung cancer. And it's just over and over. When my wife got hospice, the nurse came in, and I asked her how many patients did she have just from a place up the road we call Glen Daniel down to my place. It was about 12 miles. This is all country now. And she said that she personally had 15 patients, all cancer related, that were on hospice, and that she had never seen anything like it. And this was kind of ongoing. She'd have 15, you know, some would die, she'd pick up more. And I started asking questions around, and I found out that right around me, in a year's time, 14 people had passed from lung cancer. And there was a young boy across the river from me. He had some weird cancer. It was something that it was similar to leukemia, but it was not leukemia. It was a blood disorder, but it was caused by environment, that they had said. And and it just went on and on up and down the river. And then down the river for me, about 20 miles roughly, there's a little community, and five houses all next to each other. They all had someone that died within a few months of each other, and they found out that came to find out it was water. Mm-hmm. Ours was dust. And that's still going on there. They're still blasting. There's still people getting sick and dying. And, you know, the big problem is that West Virginia, it operates under a corrupt political system, and it's run by the coal industry. And, you know, Joe Manchin himself, he's part of this huge problem. When he gives a speech in West Virginia, the first thing he says is, "I'm Joe Manchin and I'm a friend of coal." And that is the only way you get elected in West Virginia. If you don't say, "I'm whatever your name is and I'm a friend of coal," you don't have much of a chance to be elected. People are born into this system, and, you know, they're down in the mountains and the hollows, and this is all they know. It's all their parents knew. It's all their grandparents knew. They were beaten down 150 years ago, and it's been passed down generation after generation. Right now, we have the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, who is the most corrupt entity in the whole state. They're nothing more than stooges of this political system. They are right now just gave a mountaintop removal permit to a company, Lexington Coal, who purchased all of these massive mountaintop removal sites from the previous owner. Massey Energy was the original owner. And they, after the Upper Big Branch, the big mine explosion that killed the 26 miners, I believe it was 26, they sold everything to Alpha Industries. Then Alpha sold it. And now Lexington Coal Company has it. They have committed violation after violation after violation. They've been cited for so many things by the West Virginia DEP. However, they're always given some leniency to fix this or fix that or correct this, correct that. Rarely is there a fine. And if there is a fine, we're talking $300-$400. Wow. And that's the way it works. We just pointed out to the West Virginia DEP on this new permit that Lexington is after, of all of the previous violations on that very site that they're getting their renewal permit on. And it was almost as if that Lexington was hoping their permit would be taken away. Then they could just walk away and not clean up the mess they created. They ignored a order from the West Virginia DEP to fix these things. Their permit came up. We had a hearing on it. We talked, several of us talked and pointed out all these violations. And just last week, they got their permit, regardless of all of that. So I don't know how much more corrupt, how much more obviously they show how corrupt they are.
Well, Bo, if I could cut in really quickly, I think sure. that something people would really be interested in is as you touched upon, the terrifying prospect of what these companies leave behind after the rape of the land and the mountaintop removal, and how it's structured in a way where they either let the companies go bankrupt or close them or Correct. Lose their permits and then don't have to deal with this absolutely terrifying environmental devastation that they've left in their wake.
It's a horrendous mess that they leave. When they come in, when they start blasting near you, and they will get very close. It's to me, it's an act of terror. To me, it was like incoming, being hit with artillery, and it was just you'd be in your yard and you would flinch. You'd be unexpected a blast, and then I got caught in a blast trying to get some. Video of them a couple of times, and where the dust rained right down on me. And this dust has glass in it. It's silica because all the strata in that area in southern West Virginia is sandstone, which has glass in it. And so people are breathing that. So you go through all of this terror, and you know, some people's houses, foundations crack. It just goes on and on. And like I think it was Peter or Lucas, I'm not sure which one said this before, was about the apples. You couldn't eat the apples in your trees. And I had apples, and USGS told me, don't eat them. They're toxic. Wow. And so they do all of this while they're there. And then they are allowed to file Chapter 11, and they don't pay anyone. They walk away. They don't pay their vendors. So consequently, all of the businesses that were on Coal River in the valley where I'm from, all of those local businesses, restaurants, a couple, three bars that we had, drug stores, all of these businesses go under. And people move, the ones that can. The people that can't move, they have to stay there and they have to endure this. And then when they file their Chapter 11, they walk away. And now there's this mess that's going to be there for thousands of years unless it's cleaned up. And nothing will grow on it. You can't grow a tree. You can't grow anything on it. It's just like pulverized rock. And consequently from that, the top of the mountain is now flat. It's covered with pulverized rock and a hard surface. So when these torrential rains come, you know, before they blew the mountain up and flattened it, you had all of this rich, deep topsoil and trees and shrubbery and all these things that would absorb that water. Not now. You get a good heavy rain, it just comes right down the hollows. People get their homes flooded out. Some people get their houses washed away. We've had that. Wow. And you don't know what you're going to get. And they walk away scot-free. And what they'll do a lot of times, they will go ahead and open another company either under another name, and they just repeat the process.
And just to give people a little bit of background about mountaintop removal, in the film, Peter, Paula Jean Swearingen, who has run for Senate in West Virginia, said, "I never imagined I'd wake up one day and they'd be blowing up our mountains." She said it was cheaper to blow up our mountains than pay people to go underground. And then activist Bob Kincaid said, "It's cheaper to blow up the mountain than pay thousands of workers to go underground." So can you talk more about that, just to give people some background about why this is happening?
Well, it's pure economics, right? I mean, it's what's the cheapest, quickest way to rape the landscape and get that coal out of that mountain? You know, it's not about the welfare of the people or the workers or the land or the resources. It's just, how do we get that stuff out of there as quickly, as cheaply as possible, regardless of, you know, any related costs? And there's something that I think it's important for people to remember. And, you know, Bo's probably even better versed on this historically than I am. But, you know, you think about Manchin and you think about this legacy that he's tied to, this legacy of industrial extraction and corporate exploitation. And you go back to the founding of West Virginia in 1863, when it seceded from Virginia. And West Virginia was founded by a small group of white businessmen for the sole interest of extracting resources from this land, the timber, the coal. So it is baked into the government. It is baked into the sole reason that this state was founded. And you know, Joe Manchin is just another clown who's part of this really, really horribly destructive, sad legacy. And I think it's helpful to put it in that context, I think.
Right. And also a little more context, Lucas, the activist Bob Kincaid, said the UNWA actually endorsed mountaintop removal, which does not require that many people to ruin a mountain. And as a result, the union lost members and lost power.
Right. I mean, you know, if you look at West Virginia politically, West Virginia was a Democratic stronghold for years. And I think you can directly draw a parallel to the Republican political takeover of that state to, you know, the way the union membership was, you know, actively targeted, you know, through the Friends of Coal initiative and through, you know, the clip that we heard Bo talk about at the outset of the show. And now it's one of the reddest states in the union.
Bo, to see a mountain being blown up is devastating. What is it like to actually experience it up close?
It's surreal. It when I first saw it, I just couldn't believe what I was looking at. It was hard to take it in. I heard blasting back in the mountains, and you know, I knew what strip mining was. It was from, you know, back in the early 70s, late 60s, when I was a kid. I remember that. And I thought that, you know, it was like mountaintop removal was strip mining. And I read a little bit more about it and saw, well, it's actually larger. And then I heard they started blasting back in the mountains, getting closer to my home. So I went up and I watched them for 2 weeks, what they did. It was just amazing. They just took bulldozers, these D9 bulldozers, and they push everything down the mountain. And I mean everything, trees, oaks, hickory, cherry, it didn't matter. they want to get it out of there as fast as they can, because they know what they're doing is an act of being an outlaw. And they put it, they push it down in big piles. Then they would take their old tires from all their trucks and all their equipment, and they would put that in and burn this stuff. And so the people were breathing that. Then the mountains would be smoking for weeks and weeks. This is what I watched. And then they come in with these dozers. They create these roads to go up to the top of the mountain. Then they bring in a drill, a truck with a drill. And they might drill as many as, I don't know, 500 holes, 300 holes, depends on how far down the coal is. Then in those holes, they stuff that with ammonium nitrate and diesel fuel. And the cheapest fuel they can get, and the dirtiest diesel. And that's like the Timothy McVeigh bomb, you know, in Oklahoma City. And then they blast. So they just blast all of this mountain off top of the coal. And the coal seam may only be 18 inches deep, 20 inches thick, somewhere in there. And they go down to that. And then everything that was on top of that coal then is pushed over the hill down in the valleys. That's called valley fills. And they cover the streams. Those are all headwater source streams of all the drinking water going down in Appalachian, down in the Ohio River, and all of us getting poisoned with this stuff. And then they take that seam of coal out with dozers. There's no coal miners anymore. These are just heavy equipment operators. So they take that out. And then if you think of like a layered cake, you know, you have cake, and then you have an icing, and then another layer of cake. So that little thin icing, that's the coal, and all the cake filling, that's the cake, is the, what they call it overburden. So then they just repeat the process. They blast again, they drill, they stuff, they blast. There may be 6, 7, 8 seams of coal, and they would just go systematically right down through it, pushing everything over the mountain into the valleys. And they get the coal and they're gone. And jobs, they took all of the jobs, the coal miners' jobs. And, you know, good, you know, if I comment on the UMWA for a moment, we wrote a letter to Cecil Roberts way back asking him, why aren't you opposing mountaintop removal, taking your workers' jobs? And I had a meeting with this guy, I can't remember his name right now, but anyway, Donnie Sams, that's his name. Had a meeting with him, and I asked him that specific question. He was up in the UMWA hierarchy, and he told me, he goes, well, we have brothers up on those mountains, on those sites, and we can't oppose their job. So then after I started talking to my cousins and stuff that worked in the coal mines and all that, and what happened when Don Blankenship came into Coal River and he closed all these mines down and open them back up with non-union workers, the union, they protested. They were strong there. And then Don Blankenship told Cecil Roberts, well, I'll bring some of these guys back. We have some jobs for them. And he knew what he was going to do. So he took sporadically UMWA members and put them on mountaintop removal sites. Then how does the local community oppose that? Because that's their uncles and cousins and fathers working on these sites. That's how he did it. And kind of got Cecil Roberts in a trap. And so they will not oppose mountaintop removal because they have some jobs up there. And it really irritates me because UMWA used to be about the community. My dad's retired UMWA. As always was about community when they were strong, and they just turned into this really weak act. They're not even a player anymore. It's a shame.
Do you know, we learn in the film that the lawyers working for DuPont became the leaders of the West Virginia EPA. Is that still the case?
Well, yes. They've come and gone, but the West Virginia DEP, they either have a person from the coal industry or chemical company that's run it. That is up in it, you know, up in the upper management. And the secretary of the DEP is generally someone either from chemical or coal. And right now, you know, the governor of West Virginia is a coal baron. Jim Justice, he's a coal baron. That's what he is. And he has mountaintop removal sites. And that's why you can't get the DEP to do enforce any laws or regulations. You know what their answer was on that? We asked them when they're given a permit, did you take in consideration the health, all of the health research that's out there and all the publications and all of this stuff sounded about people's health in these communities near mountaintop removal sites? And their set answer is, we're not required to look at the health issues when we issue these permits. That's their answer.
I think it's an incredibly transparent example of this revolving door between the government and the private sector, right? I've never seen anything so egregious. Bo, we haven't talked in a little while, and I know you're constantly on the Hill in D.C. trying to push legislation. You are one of my personal heroes in many ways for all of this energy and this effort that you've put into trying to fight these issues politically. Could you tell everybody a little bit about maybe what you're working on now and what people can do to help?
Yes, we're working on the AIC Act. It's the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act. Congressman John Yarmuth from Kentucky has introduced it for us for a number of years now. We got this bill originally introduced in 2012, and what it calls for is a freeze on new mountaintop removal permits and no issuing of renewal permits until a health study by the Federal Department of Health, Human Health Resource Services, comes in and conducts a health study. There's over 30 research publications, peer-reviewed and publicized research on mountaintop removal and human health. They all point to this dust. Water is one of the issues, but not everyone's drinking the water. Everyone's breathing the air. And we stick with it, but we haven't gotten far in that we were getting where I thought was very close. And then COVID hit and everything kind of went to pot. And it's still difficult to do anything in D.C. We're doing everything we're doing is really by phone. We're hoping to get down there. They're not taking any face-to-face meetings. And that's when you can be most effective. But again, back to the bill. I'm sorry, I got sidetracked a little bit there. But with the bill says that we will put an immediate freeze on new permits and conduct this health study. And no new permitting would be allowed until the Secretary of Health could declare that mountaintop removal is not harming human health or those nearby. The permits that they have, they could continue those until they're finished, because we know that they have money invested in that. We're not going to stop an ongoing permit. But what we're trying to do is stop new permits until this health study is done, and we already know what the answer is going to be. So the bill is H.R. 2073, the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act. And what people can do, they can call the Capitol switchboard. They don't know their congressman. They can go to our website. It's aicact.org. And you can simply put in your zip code there and you'll see who your representatives are and with their contact information. Their phone numbers and everything is right there. And you can call them. And the more people call, we have learned this much in Washington, D.C. The more that people call, the more effective you can bring about change. They are really leery of phone calls. They look at those as polls. And so I would just urge everyone, call every week. Call again, urge your family, urge your friends to call and tell them to pass this bill and stop this needless destruction. Wow. Mountaintop removal's not necessary. It doesn't add anything to our electrical grid. It doesn't, if they stop it tomorrow, no one's going to miss it, except, you know, people like Joe Manchin and the coal barons, so it's making hand over fist money on it.
Well, Bo, huge thanks for all the work that you do. We'd love to have you back. Bo Webb is a Vietnam vet and an anti-mountaintop removal activist who is featured in the powerful new documentary Devil Put the Coal in the Ground, which explores the legacy of coal's devastating impact on the people and the land of West Virginia, which has turned into ground zero for the opioid crisis. We've also been speaking with Peter Hutchison, co-director of the film, Lucas Sabian, co-director and editor of Devil Put the Coal in the Ground. It'll be screening at this year's Green Film Festival of San Francisco, April 17th at 6 p.m. at the Roxy Theater. You can also watch it online, and I really hope you take the time to watch this and spread the word. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Bo, Peter, and Lucas, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure. And go to the Roxy. It's one of the most amazing independent theaters in the country. Go support the Roxy.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about this year's Society of Environmental Journalists annual conference. We'll be back after this.